This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Jeremiah Jacques, contributing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine, filling in today for your regular host, Mr. Joel Hilliker. And I want to talk with you today about a subject that the newspapers very often get wrong. And it's actually a subject that hasn't even been in the headlines that much in recent years, though that is beginning to change now. And it's a subject that we'll be hearing more and more about in the months and years ahead. The subject is famine. This topic is obviously tragic and difficult to think about or talk about. When there's no food around, a starving person's body begins to break down muscle tissue so that it can keep the heart and other vital organs functioning for as long as possible. And then as the stomach atrophies, the feeling of hunger is diminished. The person stops feeling hungry. And then by the time 30% of normal body weight has been lost, a deep lethargy sets in. Because of deteriorated muscles and severely dehydrated skin, any kind of movement becomes very painful. And then once 40% of normal weight is gone, the likelihood of the person recovering is next to zero. The starving person becomes highly susceptible to communicable diseases. That's often what finally causes death. Or if disease is escaped, the person will go on living for a while, but usually they can't tell just how thirsty they are. And they're too weak to get water anyway, so it's often dehydration that is the final cause of death. It's heartbreaking to even think about this, but starvation is the way hundreds of millions of people have perished over the centuries and millennia. Over the last three decades, though, the world appeared to have almost conquered it. The scourge of famine was largely eradicated. It was banished to only the most remote and war-torn regions of the world. The risk of dying from starvation dwindled to its lowest levels, basically since civilization began. And that's why we don't hear much news of famine anymore. But today, famine is right on the verge of making a dramatic comeback. Alex DeWall is one of the foremost experts on famine and humanitarian crisis. He's published more than a dozen books on these topics. He's also the executive director of the World Peace Foundation. And earlier this year, DeWall published his latest book called Mass Starvation: The History and Future of Famine. This book combines DeWall's years and years of on-the-ground experience in Africa and elsewhere with academic rigor. And one section from this book says, quote, "Mortality in great and calamitous famines has all but disappeared, but we also have reason to be fearful." The reason, he says, to be fearful is simple. It's because humankind's recent solutions to famine are surprisingly frail. And evidence shows that humanity's food supply system may already be eroding. If and when something goes wrong, the next wave of mass famines could be the worst in history. So on the episode today, we'll talk about the history of famine and the future of this scourge, which is far from over. And I think that if you listen all the way through here, you'll see that there really is reason to be fearful, as Alex DeWall said there, but there's also reason for hope. Great hope that can actually eclipse that fear. And I think this could change your perspective on world events. As I mentioned a moment ago, newspapers often get famines wrong. Media very often say, well, you know, there was prolonged drought, there was global warming, there was overpopulation. These are the causes of famine according to the conventional wisdom and according to what we're generally told. But the truth is far darker. The truth is that famines are almost always intentional acts by certain people to intentionally starve other people.
So the point that I really want to make is that the verb to starve is transitive. Starvation is something that people do to each other. When you see people who are starving, it is not an outcome of any natural process. It is an outcome of human action.
That is Alex DeWall speaking at a lecture that he gave on May 4th of this year at Tufts University. He was discussing one of the main purposes of his latest book that I mentioned, Mass Starvation, the History and Future of Famine. And he is emphatic that in the vast majority of cases throughout history, starvation was not something that just happened. Instead, it was something that people did to one another. Famines are generally not caused by, you know, hurricanes or earthquakes or wildfires or other natural disasters. Instead, they are the product of politics. Alex DeWall's research focuses mostly on the last 150 years. And he says that in that time, around 100 million people worldwide have died in famines. And of those, a full 70% died of famines that were entirely man-made. Michael Watts is an emeritus professor of geography at the University of California, Berkeley, and he has also specialized a lot of his research on famines, and he's come to that same conclusion. Watts says that since famines are usually intentionally inflicted on people, we should think of them as silent violence. There are a few different categories of man-made famine. Here's Alex DeWall discussing the first one.
The first degree is really genocidal famine. Governments or other authorities deliberately using famine as a tool of extermination.
So in this first category are famines that resulted from government policies intentionally designed to starve certain populations to death. One extremely tragic example of this was the Nazi hunger plan of 1941. The goal was to starve populations in the Western Soviet Union and Eastern Europe to death so that they could rid the region of Slavs and Jews, whom Adolf Hitler called useless eaters. The Nazis said those people were useless eaters, and they wanted to take those fertile lands worked by them and instead make them a breadbasket for Germany. There's a high-level Nazi document that was written on May 2nd of 1941. That's just a few weeks before Germany's invasion of the Soviet Union. And this document says, quote, "The war can only be continued if the entire German armed forces are fed from Russia during the third year of the war. As a result, there is no doubt that X millions of people will starve to death if we take out from the country whatever we need." End quote. That was written by Herbert Bock, State Secretary of the Reich Ministry for Food and Agriculture. And in that particular document, Bock just says X millions. You know, he didn't specify exactly how many. But elsewhere, Herbert Bock calculated that for the plan to succeed, all urban populations of the European Soviet Union would have to be starved to death. So that's 30 million men, women, and children. And then there are other places in the Nazis' occupational guidelines, their rules basically for how to conduct themselves when they occupy certain locations. And these guidelines are really meticulous instructions about how exactly to starve various inferior peoples. One part of this focuses on daily carbohydrates, and it says Germans should be given 100% of required daily carbohydrates, but for Poles, only 76 to 77% should be given. For French, only 58% should be given to them. For Greeks, 38% should be given. And for Jewish people, 27% of the required daily amount should be given. And then there's a similar chart for protein. It says Germans should be given 97%, Poles should be given 79%, French 71%, Greeks 38%, and Jews 20%. So the instructions get very precise very mathematical. And those are just a few excerpts, which were published in a 1944 book called Axis Rule in Occupied Europe by Raphael Lemkin. But the Nazis were defeated before they could fully execute this incredibly ambitious and incredibly evil plan of mass starvation. They didn't kill all 30 million of those people. But even the most conservative estimates say that 4.7 million Soviets were killed as a result of these ambitions. And the true figure could be much higher. So 4.7 million, even at the lowest end. Just as a comparison, the Nazis killed a total of 6 million Jews in the Holocaust. Another notorious example of mass famine committed intentionally to exterminate populations was the Armenian Genocide from 1914 to 1923. And that was when the Ottoman government killed more than 1 million people, and about a quarter of those died as a result of intentional starvation and related diseases. And then still another especially grotesque example from this first category of famine was the Holodomor of the 1930s. You may have heard the August 15th episode of Trumpet Hour when Mr. Joel Hilliker interviewed trumpet writer Andrew Miller about the Holodomor. And that was a man-made famine inflicted on the people of Ukraine by Soviet leader Joseph Stalin and the Union of German Industrialists. So this was as intentional and as genocidal as it gets. And millions of people were killed as a result of it. We'll have a link in the show notes to that August 15th episode and to the article that Andrew Miller wrote about that tragedy. So that's the first category of famine, the ones when authorities deliberately use famine as a tool of extermination. And here is how Alex Duwall defines the second category.
The second, public authorities pursue policies that are the principal cause of famine and continue to pursue those policies even when they're aware that they result in famine.
The textbook example of this kind of famine was the one that resulted from Chinese communist dictator Mao Zedong's so-called Great Leap Forward. That started in 1958, just about 9 or 10 years after the Chinese Communist Party that Mao led had taken power in China. And at this time, Mao set his mind to modernizing the country, and he wanted to do it fast. His plan was to skip over that typical slow process of economic maturation and to instead transform straight from an agrarian society to an industrial superpower. And he wanted to accomplish that whole transformation in just a few years. So starting in 1958, Mao Zedong's government began relocating millions of Chinese peasants into mass communes. Each individual commune contained about 5,000 families, and the people had to surrender ownership of all of their animals and tools to the collective. No one owned anything individually. Everything became property of the commune. Individual private farming was outlawed. And this happened at an extraordinary speed. Within a year, the communists had relocated 700 million people, which is more than twice the current population of the United States. So they took, you know, two Americas worth of people and put them onto about 26,000 giant communes. Mao's goal was to simultaneously create a thriving manufacturing sector for the Chinese economy while also boosting the nation's agricultural productivity. So this was incredibly ambitious, because he was moving so many workers out of the farming sector while demanding that those who stayed in the farming sector produce more than they did before their numbers were reduced. So just a quick note about the manufacturing part of this before we get to the agricultural side. Almost all of the adults who were not assigned to farming duties were assigned to backyard steel production furnaces. Altogether, the Chinese set up about 600,000 of these backyard furnaces throughout the country. But these workers had little or no metallurgy training. And the steel that they made was of such low quality that it was almost always useless. Tools made with it fell to pieces. Buildings constructed with it didn't stand for long. And these problems were compounded by the fact that in order to meet the impossible production quotas, many of these desperate workers would often melt down useful, high-quality steel items, things like pots and pans and farming tools that had been professionally made. They would melt those things down into terribly low-grade steel just to try to meet those quotas. But as terrible as the backyard furnace idea was, the farming initiatives were even worse. Mao ordered the use of several farming techniques that he said would boost efficiency to new levels. One of these was his infamous deep plowing command. That required workers to plow and plant crops up to 6 feet deep, which anyone who knows anything about topsoil would know is a terrible idea. And then he also ordered a technique called close planting. Normally, an area of 2.5 acres would have room for about 1.5 million seedlings. But Mao said 8 times that many could be grown on the same amount of land if all the seeds were put very, very close to each other. So he ordered farmers to plant 12.5 million seedlings per 2.5 acres. And then the desire to produce more, better, faster, and cheaper also meant that fields were seldom given any time to remain fallow. Maybe the most famous of Mao's appalling farming practices was his war on sparrows. Mao accused sparrows of eating great quantities of grain seeds, and his government said the birds were, quote, public animals of capitalism. So Mao ordered the people of China to destroy sparrow nests, kill chicks wherever they found them, and bang pots and pans to frighten the birds away from landing until they dropped from the sky dead from exhaustion. These efforts, these orders, followed by so many people, dramatically depleted the population of Eurasian tree sparrows and drove them nearly to extinction. And the problem with Mao's war on sparrows was obvious to many farmers within just a few months. The problem was that the sparrows didn't just eat grain, they also ate lots and lots of insects. So without their main natural predator in the picture, insect populations, and especially locusts, boomed. These locust populations just exploded, and then they devoured vast swaths of China's crops and countryside. The flaws of Mao's other policies became equally obvious to the people who were striving to implement them. Those problems were glaring and numerous, but Mao Zedong, the great helmsman, was uninterested in hearing about those problems. Dr. Li Zizhu was Mao's personal doctor from 1955 until Mao's death in 1976. And I've got a quote here from an interview that he did with the New York Times in 1994. So this was one of Mao's closest assistants who worked with him for over 20 years there. And he said, quote, Mao was a merciless tyrant who crushed anybody who disobeyed him. The mistake of those who got purged was to see themselves as equal to Mao. He wanted everybody to be subservient. End quote. So Mao really surrounded himself only with sycophants, only with yes men, and anyone disobeying him or even offering critical feedback to him would normally be executed. So because of that, during this great leap forward, loyalty to Mao took precedence over common sense. So his officials just kept on ruthlessly enforcing these policies, such as the war on sparrows, even long after it was clear that those policies were tragically flawed. But month after month, at every failure, Mao refused to reevaluate. He refused to change, and instead he would just kill any dissenters and double down on his same disastrous policies. Mao was determined to be the man who brought communism to the world, so he wouldn't stop enforcing those murderous policies. And history shows us that the result of all this was catastrophic beyond words. By 1962, at least 36 million people had died of starvation. This has come to be called the Great Famine, and it is the largest starvation event in history. The Chinese researcher Yang Jisheng detailed this famine in his book Tombstone. I'll just read one short quote from one of his interviews. Yang said, quote, "Documents report several thousand cases where people ate each other. Parents ate their own kids. Kids ate their own parents." End quote. This is a nightmare that is very hard to even think about. And the most tragic aspect of the Great Famine is that even with Mao's faulty policies being relentlessly pursued, the bulk of the deaths were still unnecessary. Even as those fields returned paltry harvests, year after year, there were huge grain warehouses that stored enough food to feed the whole nation. But Mao's government refused to release that food to the people who needed it. The journalist John R. Platt has researched and written quite a lot about this, and he said, quote, "At the heart of it, the real cause of the Great Famine was the communist government, which either as policy or by the selfish act of various officials kept the grain from being delivered to those in need and covered up the problem." End quote. So Mao Zedong's Great Famine killed at least 36 million people. It is, as I mentioned, the worst famine in history, and it's the textbook case of the second category of famines that De Waal described there, when public authorities pursue policies that are the main cause of famine, and they keep on pursuing them even after becoming aware that they result in famine. Other notable examples of this second category of famine are Cambodian leader Pol Pot's super great leap forward, which happened in the 1970s, and then the North Korean crisis of the 1990s. And here is how Alex De Waal defines the third category of man-made famine.
The third degree is public authorities are indifferent. Their policies may not be the principal cause of famine, but they do little or nothing to alleviate the hunger.
So there it is. The third category could be called a willful failure to help. And one notable example from this category was the famine precipitated in Sudan back in 1984, when then-President Jafar Nimiri turned a blind eye to suffering caused by simultaneous drought and economic downturn. Nimiri hid the problem from the world, and he bluntly refused to accept international relief, even though relief would have easily been available. The New York Times wrote about this in 1985, just after it came to light, and said, quote, "Nimiri of the Sudan had deliberately suppressed information about the developing famine in his country, allowing the situation to develop to crisis proportions." End quote. Those crisis proportions ended up bringing famine to 10 million people, and it killed a quarter of a million of them. Okay, so altogether, this third category of easily preventable famines killed 19 million people in the last 150 years. So that's about 18% of the total number. And then the first category that we discussed, which included the hunger plan and the Holodomor, De Waal says famines in this first category killed 8.3 million people in the last 150 years, which is about 8% of the total. And then those in the second category, such as the Great Leap Forward, killed the most by far. Those killed some 64 million people, which is 62% of the total famine deaths during that time period. So if you add that up, it leaves only 13% of the total 100 million famine deaths that occurred just because of external factors that authorities were genuinely incapable of addressing. This is what newspapers usually get wrong about famine, and that's really why it's appropriate to call famines silent violence. And that's why experts like De Waal use the verb to starve in the transitive sense. Starvation is something that people do to each other. You're listening to Trumpet Hour here on KPCG-FM. When we come back, we will talk about the future of famine and about the hope that is intimately tied to it.
Is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Jeremiah Jacques. You're listening to Trumpet Hour here on KPCG-FM. I'm filling in today for your regular host, Mr. Joel Hilliker. And on the show today, we are talking about famine. In the first half, we discussed some of history's most infamous famines and showed that famine is almost always man-made. It's seldom due entirely just to nature disasters, and instead it's almost always something that men inflict upon each other. That is one of the main conclusions of Alex DeWall's new book called Mass Starvation, The History and Future of Famine. And when DeWall first started writing that book back in early 2015, he actually had a really optimistic view about mankind's progress in the war against famine. But then during the course of writing, that changed. Here is another clip from DeWall's lecture on May 4th of this year at Tufts University.
As Bridget alluded to, originally when I started working on this, I thought I could write a history of famine and say, actually, this is a problem that we have actually resolved, consigned to history. Unfortunately, during the writing, famine made something of a comeback.
So there it is. During the course of writing this book that was supposed to be a victory account of mankind stamping out famine, during the course of writing it, famine started making a comeback. That's a chilling reality. And one thing that DeWall and other famine experts often stress is that the decline of famine in the last 30 years has really been a historical anomaly. It's been very unusual, and the reason for it is in small part because of an increase in international humanitarian efforts, such as those of the World Food Program and other programs like that. There has been a huge increase in money going toward those kinds of programs. Back in 1970, there was about $128 million spent worldwide on food aid each year. But today that number has grown to about $28 billion. So that's an incredible increase, and it has helped to reduce famine deaths. But there's another more significant reason why that unusual decline in famines happened. One quote from DeWall's book says, "The main reason for the decline of famines is the decline of megalomania and of political attitudes that regard people as dispensable." So the main reason the last 30 years saw so few famines was the reduced number of leaders like Adolf Hitler and Joseph Stalin and Mao Zedong and Pol Pot and Jafar Nimeiri. Those were the megalomaniacs who saw people as dispensable. And for a few decades, there were not nearly as many of those kinds of leaders on the world scene, at least not in the most powerful countries. So that decline, along with the rising number of humanitarian aid programs and spending in those programs, it made a huge difference. And that's what made DeWall so optimistic when he started writing his book. But then in December 2016, the first red flag came. That's when the Famine Early Warning Systems Network announced that a famine was underway in some remote regions of Nigeria. Then just a month later, threats of famine had also been identified in Somalia and South Sudan, and most worryingly, in Yemen. Soon after that, alarms were also sounded over Syria. So it was clear that after years of progress, global hunger numbers were rising again and poised to rise much more. A United Nations report showed that 11% of the global population in 2017 was chronically malnourished. That's an increase of 40 million over the year before. Earlier this year, DeWall spoke to NPR and he said, quote, The past year, 2017, has been unquestionably terrible, with famine or near-famine conditions putting millions of people at risk of severe malnutrition and even death across Somalia, Sudan, Syria, Nigeria, and Yemen. And Dwal isn't the only one taking note of this change. In late 2017, Kimberly Flowers, the director of the Global Food Security Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, wrote a landmark article that was titled, "The Four Famines, The Alarm Bells Are Ringing, But Who Is Listening?" And I think that's a pressing question. Who is listening to the alarm bells? Who is watching the gains start to reverse? Who is aware of just how suddenly global stability could be shattered? I'd like to talk for just a moment about a nation not mentioned in that list above, but that is also increasingly susceptible to instability, and a kind of instability that could have far-reaching effects on the world's food supply, and that is Morocco. Just for a little bit of background information here, back in the 1960s, the prevalent use of synthetic fertilizer greatly expanded the amount of land that was usable for agriculture around the globe. And these fertilizers quadrupled the productivity of existing agricultural lands. And it was all enabled by the Haber process, which turns atmospheric nitrogen into a form that is biologically usable by crops. But the trouble is that when the amount of nitrogen in soils is increased, the vegetation requires an equal increase in phosphorus. Phosphorus is mined in the form of phosphate from geologic deposits, and modern agricultural practices depend so heavily on phosphorus that experts say virtually no one would eat in today's world without it. In 2016, The Atlantic wrote about this, saying, "Phosphorus-dependent fertilizers have allowed millions of people who would have otherwise starved to be fed." But phosphorus is not a limitless resource. Earlier this year, investment expert Jeremy Grantham spoke to Planet Money about this, and he said, quote, "We're on a finite planet with finite reserves of phosphorus. We are mining it and running through the supply. That should make the hair on the back of everybody's neck bristle." So modern agriculture is dangerously dependent on these synthetic fertilizers, and the fertilizers rely on phosphorus that is in limited supply. This limited supply of phosphorus has been well known to agricultural workers for decades, but since it was cheap, no one really worried about it. But then came 2008. When the global financial crisis struck, the price of phosphorus skyrocketed by 800%. As a result of that, food prices around the world soared. And Grantham said, quote, "I would argue that that was a shot across the bows. That was the first warning to planet Earth that we are beginning to run out of phosphorus." And then another warning shot came the following year when the U.S. Geological Survey published a report saying peak phosphorus was only 24 years away, meaning production would begin falling, maybe precipitously, after the year 2033. After those warning shots, the eyes of the world were suddenly locked on Morocco. The North African country is home to some 75% of the world's known phosphorus reserves. That's a staggering percentage. It gives Morocco a near monopoly on the multi-billion dollar trade of phosphorus. And so many countries rely on Morocco's phosphorus. The United States, which is the world's largest exporter of food, gets 42% of its phosphorus imports from Morocco. And then other major importers of Morocco's phosphorus include Mexico, Australia, New Zealand, Lithuania, Canada, and the list goes on. A journalist named Brendan Burrell recently investigated Morocco's phosphorus near monopoly, and he found that Morocco is disturbingly secretive about its reserves. Burrell said, quote, "It turns out that they don't want to tell you a lot. They're trying to use this secrecy to their advantage. That way they can dictate the price." And then Burrell says, he goes on to say, quote, "It's kind of amazing that our future food supply depends so much on what happens in this one country." That's a sobering statement. And I think a better word than amazing here may be alarming. And then the alarm becomes far more intense in light of something that's been happening in Morocco just over the last few months, and that is the growing influence of Iran. Back on May 1st, the Moroccan government announced that it had evidence that Iran was using its terrorist proxy group, Hezbollah, to support a separatist group inside Morocco called the Polisario Front. The Polisario Front's been fighting since the 1970s to make Western Sahara a separate nation. But the Moroccan government says Western Sahara is a part of Morocco. So this dispute has raged on for more than 25 years. And now Iran, the world's number one state sponsor of terrorism, is giving the Polisario Front military training and weapons. Trumpet writer Callum Wood wrote an article about Iran's sudden influence in Morocco back in August of this year. And we'll be sure to have a link to that in our show notes for today's program for anyone who would like to understand the details of this worrying trend better. But the basic point of it is that Iran would love to destabilize Morocco through groups like the Polisario Front, and they are having some success in doing this. Morocco's cache of phosphorus is actually split between Western Sahara and the rest of the country, and the government will not disclose how much of it lies on the more secure northern side of that line and how much of it lies on the southern side where Iran's destabilization efforts are focused. Geopolitical Futures wrote on August 23rd that Iran's effort to destabilize Morocco happens at a time when, quote, "Anti-West sentiment and religious zeal are both on the rise, which is raising concerns in Morocco about the potential for religious extremism to take hold." The most recent sign of this came in July when 30,000 individuals protested in the streets, including at least 6,000 members of an outlawed Islamist group and tens of thousands of youths. Geopolitical Futures wrote that these recent developments in Morocco have put that country's stability in doubt. So in any other nation, these developments would be worrisome, but since the world's food supplies depend so heavily on Morocco's phosphorus, these developments are nothing short of alarming. They show that global food supply chains are highly susceptible to disruption. So there's a very worrying situation there in Morocco, and there's also the new crises that we discussed in Nigeria, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, and Yemen. And when you place all of that alongside the recent return of authoritarian governments in several other nations, it shows that severe famines could soon be prevalent once again. I'll just read another quote here from Alex DeWall about this. He said, quote, "Insofar as we see a resurgence of ideologies and practices that reduce people to instruments or impediments to other political ends, we need to be deeply worried that mass starvation will return." End quote. If we take a look around the world today, we see Russia, China, Turkey, Iran, and several other nations where it's easy to see that the resurgence of those kinds of ideologies and practices is well underway. And this indicates that mass famines could soon return with force. And when that resurgence is placed alongside the world's most authoritative forecasting source, the sure word of Bible prophecy, that indication becomes a certainty. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has said that the biblical book of Revelation is the most misunderstood book in all of the Bible. And he's written quite a lot explaining what is misunderstood and what it actually means. And if you read Revelation 1, verse 19, it says that this book is about things which shall be hereafter. So that means things that would take place after the era of the Apostle John. And one really vital chapter of this book is Revelation 6. This is the chapter that discusses the seven seals that lead up to the return of Jesus Christ to earth. And the first four of those seven seals are often called the four horsemen of the apocalypse. Verses 1 through 8 show that these horsemen represent religious deception, war, pestilence, and famine. Verses 5 through 6 talk about the black horse, the one that represents famine. And that passage says, quote, "And when he had opened the third seal, I heard the third beast say, 'Come and see.' And I beheld, and lo, a black horse, and he that sat on him had a pair of balances in his hand. And I heard a voice in the midst of the four beasts say, 'A measure of wheat for a penny, and three measures of barley for a penny. And see that you hurt not the oil and the wine.'" End quote. So this is a personification of mass famine. This black horse is rampant starvation, cruel and unyielding. And the passage, you know, it points to a time when staple grains are so scarce that they are carefully weighed and just prohibitively expensive. Ellicott's Bible Commentary provides some valuable research about this. It says that the word measure in verse 6 means the amount of food sufficient to support a man for one day. And then the word penny refers to the usual daily pay of the laborer and of the soldier. So this means that an entire day's wages for a typical worker would only allow a man to buy enough wheat to feed himself for that same day. A measure of wheat for a penny. That's what that means. Working an entire day just to be able to feed yourself for that one day. Or such a laborer could buy enough of the less nutritious barley to feed three people, which is better, but it still means feeding a family on that wage would be nearly impossible. And then there's also a lot of meaning packed into the last part of verse 6, which says, "See that you hurt not the oil and the wine." This shows that supplies of luxury items, such as oil and wine, are mostly unaffected, but these kind of luxury items are well outside the reach of the ordinary laborer. This is selective scarcity. It spares the powerful elite while greatly afflicting the common people. And really, this is in line with Alex DeWall's description of famines as very often being intentional weapons of war in the hands of corrupt authorities against common populations. The book of Revelation isn't the only place in the Bible that mentions an end-time return of famine. In his famous Olivet prophecy, Jesus Christ himself said that mass famines will occur prior to his return. Matthew 24, verse 7 says, quote, "For nation shall rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there shall be famines." And then Christ's statements about that are also recorded in Mark 13, verse 8, and Luke 21, verse 11. Mr. Fleury, along with co-author Mr. Wayne Turgeon, wrote about the impending return of famine in their booklet, The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. And they stress in this powerful booklet that these prophecies are for the present age. The booklet says, quote, "We are not discussing some dusty old prophecies. These are dramatic, dire prophecies that lie directly in front of us. This great famine will eventually spread to every corner of the earth before mankind repents in unconditional surrender to God." And then a little further down, they write, quote, "This third horseman of famine will have a specific fulfillment. It is ready to gallop into our immediate future with an impact far beyond the historic and present-day occurrences of localized famines." From there, Mr. Fleury and Mr. Turgeon explain that even though this points to a dark future, the Bible shows that God will provide a method of escape for those who will turn to him. They write, quote, "The future appears very bleak, but there is a way of escape, as mentioned in Revelation 12, verses 13 through 17. God will hear and forgive anyone who will repent. The only ones promised divine protection are those few who have yielded to God and his way of life." So these scriptures are sobering. They reveal that the gains against famine that mankind has made in recent years will soon wither away, and that the worst of famine is still ahead. But these passages are also profoundly inspiring. They show that this is something that will happen out of love. It's a way God will reach mankind and break through human stubbornness and hard-heartedness. As Mr. Fleury and Mr. Turgeon write, "Our loving Father must allow man to go through such terrible conditions in order for us to finally learn obedience. It's not as if God brought it about. Mankind has caused its own misery by choosing not to obey God. For the sake of his rebellious children, God allows man to learn that sin does not bring happiness. It only brings much pain and suffering, and ultimately death." End quote. So it really is a way of reaching people and of helping people to live lives of abundance. And this will all happen just before Jesus Christ returns to usher in an age of prosperity and abundance and plenty. This powerful booklet goes on saying, quote, "When humanity finally realizes that only God's give way really does work, God can bless them more abundantly than ever. That is clear in Micah 4, verse 4, Isaiah 32, verse 15, and Amos 9, verses 13 and 14. Then righteous men, women, and children will mock the thought of famine, as shown in Job 5, verse 22. End quote. And then the very end of this booklet talks about the organization behind KPCG and behind the Philadelphia Trumpet. And it talks about what each individual can do with this knowledge. It says, quote, "The Philadelphia Church of God is continually providing hope for those willing to yield their natural stubborn natures to the will of God. Doomsayers only tell how bad things will get, but without the hope of how much better it will soon be. Jesus Christ is soon returning to this earth to bring it all the joy and happiness man has continually sought after. God will mercifully end the deadly sweep of the four horsemen just before they eradicate mankind from off the earth. Finally, man will have the sweet childlike attitude that God can work with in the world tomorrow. Are we each working out our own salvation with fear and trembling, so we can be part of God's great master plan for humanity?" I'm Jeremiah Jacques. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Thank you for listening today, and please go to thetrumpet.com and click on the literature tab to order a free copy of The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. This booklet does a masterful job of explaining these dire prophecies that lie directly in front of us, and the method of escape that is available to those who turn to God. There's no shipping charge for this booklet, no charge of any kind, no follow-up. So please go to thetrumpet.com and order a copy of this potentially life-changing booklet. Feel free also to send us your thoughts and questions about the program today by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan, and we'll leave you today with this thought from the world-renowned educator, the late Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong. "This advanced good news of tomorrow is as certain as the rising of tomorrow's sun. Humanity won't bring it about. It is going to be done to us. Humanity is going to be forced to be happy, to enjoy world peace, to see universal abundance and joy fill the earth." Thank you for joining us. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.